All right, welcome to class. Before we dive ahead, are there comments, questions, concerns, other things for me? Yes.
At the beginning of the class, one of the first quiz you asked if we knew why there was a red chair.
Yeah.
Can you explain why there's a red chair?
Why? Yeah. Oh, you wanted me to actually do it. Oh, sorry. You asked if I could. That was a predicate. Anyway, no. Yeah, so when I first taught this class, five years ago, I first taught this class. At that point, there was a big campaign with NCWIT called the Sit With Me campaign, which was trying to raise awareness of gender in computing. And the red chair was their emblem. I wonder if any of those web pages even still exist. Let's see. The URL still exists. Oh, there it is. So they had this all kinds of money trying to push out. You'll actually see some copies of this chair floating around our, I think we have four of them in the CS department that we purchased. Anyway, there was this big push to try to support diversity in tech with sitting in a red chair. There was a lot of ideas behind it that I don't know that ever really worked. So there's a lot of push, and then only people that were pushing knew what they were pushing, and it just didn't work. But anyway, huh? So the concept originally was that you should sit and have a conversation, that you shouldn't think about people as big entities, but as individuals by talking to them, theoretically. Anyway, this was happening, and I believe in diversity in tech, and so it was happening, and they had a 3D model of red chair, and so I grabbed it, and we used it, and now I have all these pictures of it, so many pictures of it, so many more than you have seen. Anyway, that's why the red chair. Other questions? All right. So today we're going to begin, let's say, five classes sort of on physics and stuff. And we're going to start today with virtually no physics, probably none at all. We'll do some math, but we're mostly going to talk about how do you actually represent stuff if you're going to simulate it. And so let's just start by talking about how you've represented stuff so far. Right? You've just had a big list of points, right? So you've had a list of points and you had a list of indices. So you've had a list of three indices, however your language likes to put this, right? And each triple of indices is a triangle and poof, information. This is a very efficient way of representing information for the purpose of drawing, which is what we've been doing. It is not a particularly good way of representing information for anything involving trying to edit geometry. It is nice in the sense that if I move a vertex, all of the points attached to it move, right? So if I have some vertex here that is at the intersection of three triangles and I move the point, all three of the triangles have their point moved because there's only one copy. That's good. But if I wanted to ask, for example, how pointy is that point? Is it a flat point or is it a very spiky point? This would involve some sort of math on the surrounding faces. And finding the surrounding faces means first finding the index of the point, maybe that's given, and then looping through all of the triangles that exist and counting up all of the ones. This is a linear search, right? And it generally can't be other than a linear search, because I cannot in general store the triangles in any predictable order to allow a binary search or the like. This is inefficient if we wanted to, for example, say, make the spiky points less spiky. Even simple kinds of mesh editing is messy if this is how we represent things. So it's efficient, it's space efficient, it's time efficient for drawing. And we often will reduce things like to this form before we draw, as all of your assignments have done so far. But it's not an efficient way for anything more complicated. So we're going to start with just how we represent meshes, and we'll work our way up to how to represent all kinds of other things and prepare to talk about physics today. Before I move on, questions about this representation? All right, this is often just called arrays. Technically, there's a vertex array and an index array, but meh. All right, speaking of calling things, though, let's just talk a little bit about some vocabulary. So that here is a vertex, and this is an edge. And this, what do we call this?
Face.
So many names. It could be a face or?
A triangle.
Or a triangle. Or?
Surface.
A surface. Or? A facet. Or? Anyway, there's lots of them. Now, some of these have special meanings. Triangles have three vertices. Of course, triangle really means it has three angles, linguistically, but we never mean that. We always mean it has three vertices. Surface we usually use to refer to a set of contiguous faces. So it is uncommon to refer to just one of them as a surface. Typically we talk about this whole thing as a surface, assuming that it is a surface, assuming that it could be flattened, right? Or that it doesn't have weird fan type shapes. So an example of some triangles that would not be a surface is if my triangles were arrayed like this. This is not a surface. There's no way of aligning these because there are three triangles sharing an edge. It is not, it can't be pushed to a planar configuration. Okay? And so when we talk about surfaces, we want them to have this nice property where each edge is faced, is either shared by one or two faces and not three. Okay? Some people use face and facet in different ways. Others don't. I won't because I don't think the nuance of difference matters enough to be worth talking about, but you'll see them both discussed. Yes?
In that example down there, is that the third triangle on the left, like behind?
Yeah. Yeah, the concept is we have three triangles that are all intersected, all sharing one edge, and drawing behind is not an easy thing to do in 2D. Other questions? All right, so how do we represent this stuff? Data structures is, of course, the answer, and there's a lot of them. Okay? We are not going to talk about even a tiny fraction of the data structures that exist for storing information. We're going to talk about one of the more common baseline ones, and then we'll hand wave a couple of others and then talk about another one that's useful in simulation and move on. The first one we're going to talk about is called the half edge. Okay, the half edge is a useful technique for storing surfaces. Okay, surfaces made out of faces of any numbers of sides, but it isn't good for storing non-surface information. There are modifications of it that will store non-surface information, but the simplest version does not. So let's imagine that we want to represent, I don't know, I'll just draw something more or less at random. Okay, so here is my mesh. I should have mentioned the word mesh. If we have some surface or the like represented by points or vertices attached to each other, we call that a mesh. There are actually more terms we'll need in mesh, and I'll get to some of those a little later. Non-self-intersecting and so on. But anyway, we'll get to some of that in a bit. So, here I have my mesh. The idea of the half edge is I'm going to have one data structure for each half of each edge. Okay? And what do I mean by a data structure for a half of an edge? Conceptually, I am going to have a data structure that goes from this vertex along this side of that edge and another one that goes along the other side. Okay? And why would I do this? Well, it turns out it makes it nice to have boundaries if I can tell if there's another half of the edge or not. So these edges, there's a second half for, but if this is the boundary of the shape, then this edge has only one half, and there is nothing on the other half. That tells me I've arrived at the edge of the mesh, the edge of the surface. Okay? So what does each of the half edges need to know? Each half edge, it turns out, can be just three pointers. So what we're going to store in each half edge, it's going to have a pointer to its vertex, a pointer to its other half, and a pointer to the next half edge around its face. Okay? So it's going to have one pointer to a vertex, two pointers to half edges. One half edge is its pair, the other one is the next one. And this information turns out that we can find our way around the mesh. Okay, so let's think about this. If we were to sort of make it as, I don't know, I've been teaching C lately in my other class, we'll say it's a struct. If I make it as a struct half edge, right? What is inside the struct? I'm going to have a vertex pointer, and we typically think of this as the vertex that it came from. Okay, so this is the vertex that edge is leaving. Okay, I have a half edge pointer that is going to be the pair of this, the opposite one, where our blue edge has null and our red edge has the other pair in this particular drawing, right? So it's the one across the way. And then we also have the next one in line, okay? The next one around this face. And with these, we can find all of the information we need. If we want to find all of the edges and vertices around one face, we just keep following the next pointers until we get back where we started. If we want their vertex for each of those half edges, we find the vertex it came from. And so we can find all the vertexes for a face. If I want to find the faces that it was a pair of for each of those half edges, I check the pair and I'll get the opposite edge. If I wanted to go backwards, if I wanted to know the edge before my edge, I can do that without going all the way around by going to the pair, going next, and then coming back, right? It's a little bit messy, then you have to go around all the edges, but we can find all of the edges that leave a vertex by going pair, forward, pair, forward, pair, forward. Anyway, all of the things you can do with this are not the real point of this. It gives us all the power we need. And it's commonly used as a simple way of representing information. Yes?
So is there only like one next?
There's one next for each half edge.
Okay, so from that, say the top next, what about like for a different one of those shapes that you have in common?
Okay.
Yeah, if you were talking about like the shape with four sides above it.
So I would have a half edge here,
yeah.
And here,
but
and
that,
here.
The one that you drew, not the last one.
Uh-huh.
The one you drew?
Yeah.
That's not like a next from
there. It's the next from this one.
Okay.
And that's next is there, and that's next is there, and that's next is there.
Okay.
So if I follow the next, I'll go around one face. We are always consistent in the winding. Whether it's counterclockwise or clockwise depends on which side you're looking at the mesh from. So it breaks if I have both half edges pointing the same direction. I stop being able to get some information. So two half edges have to be pointing in opposite directions for it to work out well. And then we can sort of go around in these circular things. If we think about this as a linked list, our next pointers create a circular linked list, right? There is no beginning or end. You can go all the way around. And so the coding to deal with these is a little bit different, perhaps, than some coding you've seen before. A sort of iterator loop in the simplest form won't work because it will never know when to stop. And so instead, you keep track of where you started and you go until you get there again. Or until the next thing would be that. There's different ways of writing this code in different languages. Okay. Other questions about our half edge structure? All right. This is a one-way structure. You have to go around to get back to where you started. There is a two-way version of it where we just have the other pointers, which is called winged edge. And there is actually, it's somewhat decreased in popularity, but for many years, one of the more popular free mesh editing software was called Wings because it used winged data structures. And it's still out there. You can still learn it. And it was based just, we have the data structure, we'll name the whole program after it. Yes?
Is that analogous to like a
doubly linked list? Yeah, so if we make this doubly linked, where do we end up? We end up with wings. Yeah. Of course, there's sort of multiple linked lists going on here. So, but if we sort of do that analogy, we'll get there. Okay? So this allows us, if we have a vertex with one of its half edges, we can find all of the edges around it. Therefore, we can find all of its neighboring vertices. We can find all of its neighboring faces. Right? We can find the kind of information that will likely be useful to do some sort of procedural modification of the shape. Okay? So we want to smooth it out, for example. We might say for each vertex, move it to the average of its neighboring vertices, the basicest kind of smoothing. If that's what you want to do here, we can find all of the neighboring vertices. Right? If we wanted to do some sort of subdivision rule, we can find the center of the face because we know all of its vertices, etc. It gives us the minimal necessary power from any common mesh editing. Yes?
So if you wanted to find the neighboring vertices, would you use, how would you find the nearest one to this one? So you could do the next and find that vertex, but then you would need to do like the pair and then its next.
Yeah, so let's see if we can find all of the neighbors of this vertex. Okay. This is actually another little nuance. Our vertex will typically have inside of it, in addition to X, Y, Z, etc., it will typically have exactly one half edge pointer. Doesn't matter which one, you just have to get to one of the edges to get all the data you want. So if I have a vertex, I find one of its half edges. Okay. So I have the vertex first. I'm going to go to its edge. Okay. Let's just suppose arbitrarily that this was the edge of that vertex. Now I want to know all of the other vertices. So how I'm going to find that is I'm going to find the pair of that, which will be here. And that thing's vertex is one of the ones I want. Okay? But I also want more. So I'm also going to find that pair's next. That's going to be this one. This pair is going to be that one. And its vertex is going to be another one that I want. Right? Let me line this up a little bit better so my lining up makes some sense, to me at least. I don't know if my alignment makes any sense to anybody else. Okay. And then I also want, in addition to that, I also want this one's next pair's vertex, and this one's next pair's vertex, and so on until I get back where I started. And so each of these, I have an edge, I find its next, I find its pair, there's its vertex, I find its next, I find its pair, there's its vertex, I find its next, I find its pair, there's its vertex. So I can find all the vertices that are attached by edges. I'm seeing some puzzled looks. Yes?
What is the time improvement that this provides over like the arrays?
Things go from linear in amount of geometry to constant in amount of geometry. Right? What is the big O of this process? It's the number of neighboring vertices. For real meshes, that turns out to almost always be 6. Okay? Why 6? We could go through it in some detail, but it turns out empirically, you can make pathological meshes that have a much higher connectivity. But typically, the number of nodes around it is 6 if they're triangles and smaller if they're bigger. And so this turns into essentially a constant runtime to find that for each individual vertex. Yes?
How do you know when to stop?
When you get back to a half edge you've seen before. So we'll take this first one here, and that will be our stopping criteria. Okay? And when any one of these nets gives us that edge, then we've looped around. Yes?
Is there a problem for cache coherency when you have a bunch of linked lists going around?
Sure, but it's not really easy to get around that. Okay? Because the meshes themselves don't line up nicely unless they have unusual geometry. It tends to be hard to arrange your mesh so that the vertices that are interesting are all next to each other for all sets of vertices. Yes?
When you're making your half edges, if we had like a triangle on top of the rightmost two,
yeah.
With
like here? Or up here?
The
rightmost two, here.
Yeah.
You want a triangle here?
Mm-hmm. How would we handle
that? Okay, that's a triangle. That's overlapping. Okay, that's fine. We can do that.
If we had, like, so both of the two shapes currently have, there's different phases, but then you would have a third one connecting both of them, and so it has a single edge that has two.
So if I wanted to add that edge, I would need to add no new vertices, but I need to add three half edges. Because it's a three-sided shape. So we'll have its three half edges. And so then this one will be attached sort of around the back to that half edge. This one will be attached around the back to that half edge. So I have three new half edges and two new paralinks. And ta-da, I'm done.
Okay. Sorry, in my head I was thinking they would go in opposite directions.
Nope. We can always, if it is a consistent surface, we can find a winding that works. Okay? Now you can create surfaces where this won't work, where your windings won't work, things like clean bottles and so on don't behave nicely with this, right? But for if your mesh could represent a subset of the surface of a solid, then this will work, okay? There are some other cases where it will also work, but that will always work. And since often we're using meshes to be the outside of some physical object, this works for a lot of real modeling problems. Although there are cases where it will fail. There are extensions of this to be much messier. Okay? What if we wanted to be able to have these things? What if we wanted to be able to have some edges aren't attached to a face, they're just edges sitting out by themselves? Okay? If you want those kinds of features, this model won't work. And there are extensions of this model. One of the one that was made significant sort of internal news in the graphics community back in 2008, and then promptly everybody forgot it was new later, was called the B-Mesh, which takes these ideas and adds a few other. They have a face object as well, so that you can have each of these point to their face or not, and a handful of other modifications, and suddenly you can do just about anything, and that was really cool when they came up with it, and then everybody said, oh, it's just more pointers, who really cares, right? It's surprisingly hard to find documentation of these things, because they're just not very interesting. Right? The data structure is a handful of pointers, and somebody writes the code once, and then everybody uses the code. Right? And so you can find half edges reasonably documented. You can occasionally find documents of the winged version of it. There is officially documentation of B-Mesh round and some other mesh models as well, but they're harder to find because it's just, usually you just grab the source code from somebody and run with it. Okay. Questions about our mesh data structures? All right. If you decide to make a mesh editing software, you will suddenly need to come back to this and think about it a lot. Most people don't. So we're going to move on to other things. Okay? Things that people do significantly more often. So, we're going to talk about cyclical meshes. And to understand cyclical meshes, we have to define simplex. Okay? And so we're going to define simplex initially by example. We have a 0 simplex, and a 1 simplex, and a 2 simplex, and a 3 simplex, and then we will stop because 4 simplexes I don't know how to draw. Well, I do, but I don't know how to draw them in a way that you will understand. Okay? So a 0 simplex is easy. It is a point. Okay? And then the principle of simplexes, we'll talk about as we go, but one simplex is 2 0 simplexes connected. And a 2 simplex is 3 0 simplexes with 1 simplexes between them, or a triangle. A 3 simplex, therefore, will be 4 0 simplexes connected to make a tetrahedron. What would the next one look like? How many points would it have?
Like a tetrahedron, a smaller tetrahedron fully connected.
Yeah. It's going to have, so notice how many points do we have? We went 1, 2, 3, 4, the next one would have 5. So an n simplex has n plus 1 vertices, and the vertices are connected by n plus 1 and minus 1 simplices. I tried various ways of looking at this. It doesn't matter if you write it down or say it, it always sounds weird, okay? I think it's easier by example, right? But we aren't going to have to deal with 4D or beyond because computer graphics, right? We may have a session where we'll talk a little about how we do that. But this is the concept of simplex. Simplices are convenient in a lot of ways. They have nice linearity properties. DDA works on them in arbitrary dimensions, not that we ever run it beyond two dimensions. The math of them works out nicely. And so sometimes we will want a simplical mesh. That is a mesh made out of simplices. So a simplical surface mesh is a mesh made out of triangles, only triangles. No quads, no pentagons, only triangles. And a simplical mesh could be represented with a half-edge data structure or the like, but we can do something that is more useful for computation, requires fewer steps for computation, okay? So let's imagine our two simplex. If we want to have a simplical mesh made out of two simplices, each simplex needs to know three vertices, and it has three neighbors. Okay, and so I can store the simplex by having an array of three vertex pointers, an array of three neighbor pointers. And this actually has some significant power. There's a tradition that makes our computation a little easier. And if we labor these 1, 2, and 3, then we'll make the opposite, the neighbor that is opposite a vertex will have the same index. So this will have 0, 1, and 2, okay? You don't have to do this, but if you keep this pattern in mind, then you can just use some indices to do your math without following a lot of pointers and jumping around. Okay? And so this model of having a simplical mesh, right? A simplex here would be made out of a list of simplex pointers, 3 of them, and a list of vertex pointers, 3 of them. And that is my whole simplex. Yes?
Does that kind of tradition kind of give you an implicit normal vector because you can use the counterclockwise-ness or counterclockwise
correct.
Of the indices to determine the
normal right. vector? Right. I still have an order, so I can still say, was this clockwise or counterclockwise? I can still get the normal vector. I could recreate the half edges if I needed them for something. But I also can just walk across the mesh knowing what vertex is opposite what other thing and so on. And this extends very nicely to larger dimensions. So if I need, instead of a partition of a surface, if I need a partition of the volume, it turns out that you can always partition volumes into simplices if you're willing to add extraneous points. Anyway, it turns out that in 2D, you can always turn things into triangles. In 3D, every once in a while, you have to add another extra magic vertex to make it work. And the proof of that is, I don't want to go into right now, but we can find them, we can add them, we can make it work, we can turn volumes into tetrahedra, we can turn surfaces into triangles, we can turn lines into line segments, but that is less interesting for most of what we're likely going to do. Question?
So, what are you saying about like the counterclockwise or clockwise?
Yeah.
Is there an analogous thing for tetrahedra?
Yes, there is.
What is it?
It is, in general, this is always the sign of a determinant. Okay, and so I can have correctly and incorrectly wound tetrahedra relative to each other. Anyway, and it's hard for us to think about what that means. But conceptually, what we could say is, if you think about one face, is the other vertex on the clockwise or counterclockwise side of it. Okay, and it is possible to set up our tetrahedra so that's consistent for all sides, modulo some swapping signs. And anyway. And that will actually matter for some fluid simulations. So we may come back to that. Yes?
Do these work better for like one face and self-intersecting kind of 3D solids or meshes?
No. Okay. I can create half edges from this. So there is nothing that this can do that a half edge can't do. So everything the half edge is bad at, this is also bad at. And it has additional limitations that it only represents triangles. However, it's much more efficient. Okay, and typically when we're thinking about simulations, Those weird cases are cases that can't exist in the real world, right? If my surface can't be represented as half edges or as a simplical mesh, then it can't exist. It is something I made up that intersects itself. The real world doesn't intersect itself, right? And so we can sort of hand wave away those problems for the case where physics works. That's actually also nice, because if we use a model like this, we don't have to come up with the physics for the case where it won't work. We've sort of embedded in the data structure some assumptions about the real world. And that means we have fewer conditions to check those assumptions inside our code. Other questions about our simplical meshes? All right. I thought about trying to draw a three simplical mesh, and that's just really hard, so we're just going to do it. We're going to look for a simplex of a bunny. Memory serves, I tried several searches. I think this is the one that worked. No, it's not. That is not what we want. No, here, nope, that's the outer surface. I know I made this work. No, I just keep finding this picture. Maybe this is on this page that has more. Let's see. Nope, that is not going to have it. Nope, all right. Well, I know I found a search that worked. I should have written it down, because I did too many other things since then. Sorry? No, I want the Stanford bunny. Let's see if the Stanford bunny will make this work better. Simplex Stanford bunny volume. Well, there's lots of, here we have one. This isn't the one I saw before, but this is the idea. Hey, here is a bunny, and it is completely decomposed inside with simplices. And how do we draw it? We cut away some of the simplices, and what we just see is another bunny, right? Now, this has created a whole bunch of points inside the bunny. Sometimes we won't create a whole lot of points inside the bunny, but usually if we care about the volume, we care about the points inside the volume. And there are efficient algorithms for generating this, and we can do that along the way. So we can create these simplices, and then once we have this, we just have a bunch of points and a bunch of arrays. Nice, all the size 4, we know how they're all connected, they'll all have the same winding, it'll give us a nice decomposition of space. Yes?
It's hard to tell from the image, but are all the simplices equilateral?
No.
They're not necessarily equilateral.
You actually cannot make an equilateral simplical breakdown of 3D space. You can of 2D and 1D, but not of 3D. So they will never be equilateral. But we do want to shoot for some kind of approximation to that. So there's actually what we call well-conditioned and poorly conditioned. Let's talk just briefly about a well-conditioned versus poorly conditioned simplices. Let's give some examples of poorly conditioned simplices. This one, we don't like this one very much. Okay, that's not near, these are some bad ones. We don't like these. Okay, these are bad simplices, and this one is a good one. Bad. Good. Why? Okay, for a lot of simulations, what we care about is sort of, we're treating the entire simplex as being a sample of space. And so we want it to sort of be round. We want it to be fat. We want it to be chubby. Okay, in 2D, we can handle this, right? We can detect these cases. This is a lot easier to detect than that. Right? This one is just, there's a short edge. That's a bad scenario. Okay, a really short edge, a really long edge, that's bad. Okay, we can figure this out by measuring edge lengths to some degree as well. In 3D, there is another bad case that is hard to detect with just edge lengths, which is also going to be hard to draw. We're sort of going to say, okay, we'll draw it like this. We have, essentially, it's almost flat. Opposite edges just about touch. Not quite. All of the edges are long. Similar in some ways to this. But there's these two edges that almost touch. You have a very thin tetrahedron. And this one's messy to deal with because there's no points here. We have this place where they almost touch and there's no vertices. Anyway, getting rid of ill-conditioned tetrahedra is a part of creating a good tetrahedration of space that we will care about for some things we're going to do. There are some nuances to this that we aren't going to talk about, but we are going to talk about one definition of goodness, of how we make the best simplical decomposition of space we can, or decomposition of a set of vertices we can. Okay? And that is going to be called the Delaunay. This is somebody's name. I have no idea how the poor Delaunay family pronounces their name. So sorry if I say it wrong. When I learned this, it was called Delaunay. So I will keep saying that because I haven't met one yet. All right, so the Delaunay triangulation has this particular rule, and this is the core of this we will explain with the following question. Given I have a quad, which way should I chop it into two triangles? Okay, there are two options. I could go this way, or I could go this way. And so Delaunay tries to say, which is the right one? How do we decide between them? And the Delaunay rule is going to get more into geometry than you, well, maybe you expected geometry in this class. This is going to use what we call the empty circumcircle rule. So now I have to describe what a circumcircle is, I assume. How many of you could define circumcircle? Oh, a few, okay. So, let's talk about circumcircles. Let's talk about circles and triangles generally. So, if I have a triangle, there are several circles we can define based on this triangle. Okay? Several sort of unique circles. There's actually a whole lot of them, and this is interesting in geometry in lots of ways. We have the thing we call the incircle, which is the circle that touches the three edges on the inside. Okay? There are other circles that matter at various places, but the circumcircle is the one that passes through the three vertices. If the vertices are not collinear, there is one unique circumcircle. There's one unique circle that passes through the three vertices. And there is only one of them. And I didn't draw it as a circle because I am not great at drawing circumcircles. But, you know, this is the concept. Yes?
If they are collinear, wouldn't it just be the diameter?
If they're collinear, what circle passes through the three?
Oh, it passes through.
It's an infinitely large one, and it exists on both sides. Right? But if they're not collinear and not co-pointed, right, if they lie in general position, then we have a well-defined unique circumcircle. There's actually a lot of things we will care about with circumcircles in some aspects of computational geometry and simulation. So the circumcircle's center is called the circumcenter, and the circumcircle's radius is called the circumradius. And sometimes we will talk about circumcircles and circumcenters and circumradii. Okay? But the empty circumcircle rule says that when all of the circumcircles of all of the triangles I draw should contain no vertices. Okay? So what does that mean? Let's start with ones that do. If I were to draw the circumcircle between these three points, the circumcircle that goes between those points is going to look something, I didn't draw it big enough. It's going to look something like this. Okay, and I'm bad at that. It contains a vertex. So that is not an empty circumcircle. There is a vertex inside it. Okay, on the other hand, the circumcircle that goes through these three vertices, okay, it may get close to that one, but I am just sort of guessing what it looks like. But it looks something like this, and it does not contain that vertex. Okay. One of the things that Delaunay proved is that if you have a planar arrangement of points, there always exists a unique triangulation of their convex hull that obeys the empty circumcircle rule, as long as you don't have anywhere there are four points that lie in the same circle. And then if you do, there are multiple of them, right? So a square, both triangulations of a perfect square meet this empty circumcircle rule. So the Dilinating triangulation has this rule. We can also extend it to 3D and have the empty circumsphere rule and any other dimension we want, because every simplex has a circumball, and we can always find a unique breakdown of those points with these things empty. And this isn't sufficient to guarantee well-conditioned triangles, but it's a pretty good step in the right direction. And in 2D, it's actually as good as we can get. In 3D, occasionally, you have to do a few little tweaks to it. But this is as good as we can get in 2D. Okay? This is actually used for lots of purposes. It's not just used for simulation. It just sort of creates nicely shaped triangles. And so it's not uncommon if you have a point cloud, as, for example, you might get by a 3D scanner, to use some version of the Dilinating triangulation to try to get a nice triangulation of the set of points. Okay? So, on that, let's talk about, oh no, where did I put it? Let's talk about alpha shapes. An alpha shape is a way of saying, you gave me a bunch of points, I want to show you a reasonable outline of them. Okay? And this example here is designed to be a hard example, right? At one extreme, we have the thing called the convex hull. I think we mentioned this briefly in the past, but let's just remind ourselves. A convex hull is what you would get if they were all nails and you put a rubber band around the whole thing. That's the convex hull. Okay? At the other extreme, we have the minimum spanning tree, which you learned about in algorithms. Okay? The alpha shape is a way of getting all of the shapes in between. And what it does, I think they had a good picture here. I hope they had a good picture here. No, they didn't. No, where else did I see a good picture? Maybe this one will do it. Yes. All right, how do you do this? The basic principle, this is actually from the user manual of a library you can use to do this. The principle here is you pick some particular sphere size, and if that sphere can't get through the mesh, then you found a boundary. This is the definition of the alpha shape. But notice these are spheres that touch two points. Spheres that touch points are something Dilinating triangulations have. So another definition of the alpha shape is we make the Dilinating triangulation of the set of points, and then we delete all of the long edges. And we're left with the alpha shape. Okay? So if we were to find, like, what is the triangle that would go in here, it's going to have long edges, longer than our minimum size. So we can pick any length we want, chop out the edges longer than that size, and end up with having removed the portions we don't want. So we can create this with the Dilinating triangulation. If you start looking down the line of computational geometry, you'll find Dilinating triangulations are halfway along the way to almost everything. Huge, huge quantities of things we are interested in. From nicely defined nearest neighbors, to alpha shapes, to how do we smooth things out, to what did we mean by smooth. Almost always it's like, create the Dilinating triangulation and then do something else. Because it makes it a whole lot easier if you know this thing. So it will show up a lot. There's lots of algorithms for creating it. There's sort of competitions for having the fastest one, because it's never really efficient, but it's close to sorting in practice. And so we have these ideas. And we can do this also in 3D and create things like this, where this was a taken by the KKR Bloch spectral function, right? I don't know what that is, but whatever it is, it maybe uses in addition to the alpha shape, right? But you take a bunch of points, you say, what's the alpha shape around it? You get some shape, okay? And this is a common step along the way of doing all kinds of 3D reconstruction from noisy data sets, and so on. We use it quite a lot. And there's also 3D, the Seagal page will also, I believe, have pictures of the 3D ones and extra things we can control there. It may have the same picture, right? So we have a set of shapes, right? A set of points. And we can say, turn them into a shape for us. And it can do these things by taking the Dehalenian triangulation or tetrahedron of space and then deleting all the long edges. And we end up with what we want. All right. Questions about Dehalenian? Yeah?
So it's still triangulated inside of the shape.
Yep.
So you're trying to like fit the shape onto a set of vertices?
Yep. That's the goal, is to find what is the shape these vertices represent. And there's not a single definition, right? So we have this parameter, how long does the distance have to be before we cut it, that alpha shapes gives us. Yeah?
Is the parameter called alpha? Or?
I believe it is. I could be wrong. I've never actually seen it called alpha in practice because alpha is painful to type.
They just said for the same value.
Oh.
For a large enough alpha value.
Yeah, so I think they are calling it alpha here. Yeah. Okay. And there's actually techniques you can use to get just the surface. Okay, so this 2D surface, this triangulation, is a simplical triangulation, is the boundary between the tetrahedra that have the boundary of tetrahedra, right? These are the tetrahedra that don't have a neighboring tetrahedra's face, that doesn't have a paired face. And so we can create the tetrahedra and then extract just the surface, or we keep the tetrahedra to note that there are points internal. There's different ways of doing this. All right. So this is a tool that will show up over and over and over again in lots of things we do. And usually we'll just assume you solved the problem. Okay? If you want to write your own Dehalenian triangulation, in 2D it's pretty straightforward. In 3D you'll wish you hadn't tried. Okay, but there's lots of libraries out there and lots of languages if you need it for something you want to do, for example, if you decide to do something with this in your project. One thing to mention about this is about the dual of a triangulation. Okay, so if I consider a set of points here, and I give some triangulation of them. Okay, so I'm just going to do something that's maybe slightly like a Dehalenian, but I'm not actually going to try to measure all the circles. But I have some triangulation. The dual of this basically just means we flip the edges 90 degrees. Okay, and so if we flip the edges 90 degrees, we end up with cells. We end up with these little cells that go around each of these points. And we don't actually flip them 90 degrees, we usually slice them in the middle, but this idea is that we can say sort of what is the region around this point. Okay, and we can make the dual. Now, the actual way we do this is we actually find the circumcenters of each of the triangles and connect them. There's other ways of deriving it, but that's the one that we actually use. These cells have a name as well. They are called Voronoi cells. Okay? And the Voronoi cell has the property that it includes all of the space that is closer to a vertex than to any other vertex. And that also is a useful thing to know. And so if we can create the Dehalenian triangulation, we create the Voronoi cell. If we can create the Voronoi cell, we can create the Dehalenian triangulation. They have the same information as one another. Yes?
Might be a dumb question, but is the circumcenter guaranteed to be within the triangle?
No.
Okay.
And that is correct. If we think about what is the set of spaces that is closer to this point than to either of these, it extends outside of the space. Right? So the circumcenter of this might be out there someplace. And that might be the line that we're going to connect to this circumcenter of that one to be the space that's closer to this point than that. Right? And this one's circumcenter is right over there, and so we're going to end up going well outside the space to find the stuff that was closer to this than to that, than to either of its neighbors. Other questions? Yes?
When you first said you flipped the edges 90 degrees,
yep.
What does that mean?
I literally mean that we create a new line that is perpendicular to and running through the middle of each edge. Yeah?
Are those lines the same length as the edges? Or
in general, no. Yeah. There's no real correlation between length of edge and length of rotated edge.
And then what was the property you said again?
Voronoi cell is all points that are closer to this vertex than any other. Okay? So it's the space that is closest to this point. Or in other words, if we were to say these are the set of points initially, and we were to shoot random points into space and say, what's your nearest neighbor? The answer would always be the point that's in my Voronoi cell. Yes?
I've heard of Voronoi diagrams before. Is that just like a bunch of these contiguous
cells? Yeah, so a Voronoi diagram is to a Voronoi cell what a Delaunay triangulation is to a Delaunay triangle. Just all of the Voronoi cells together make the Voronoi diagram. Yes?
So just another way to say it would be like one Voronoi cell contains all the points for which that vertex is the closest vertex.
Yes. Other questions? All right. So, let's just review a bit before I go forward. Okay. So we want to represent a surface or a volume. Okay? And so we've talked about how we can do this using arbitrary faces with something like the half edge. But often it's cleaner if we imagine everything's a simplex. And so using a simplex, we can break the world into that using, again, an even simpler data structure, more efficient. But we want them to be nice. We don't want ugly ones unless we have to have them. Okay? And one of the ways of saying the nicest possible given the points is the Delaunay property. And because it is related to this, the closest, because it is the best conditioned, it has various nice properties. Okay? The points that are near the Delaunay vertex are, in some sense, the correct neighbors. They are the neighbors that bound the Voronoi cell. They are the neighbors that when you get stop being close to this, you'll be close to one of them next. Right? So there's all kinds of properties that make Delaunay convenient, and so we use them quite a bit. Okay? However, they're arbitrary. And sometimes we like things to be just really clean and regular. And so we're going to talk about a much cleaner and regular version of them, way cleaner and more regular than this. So before we go on, any questions about our cells, triangles, simplices? I'm going to just walk away from them for the rest of today. Yes?
So what exactly did you define the dual to be?
The dual of the Delaunay triangulation is the Voronoi of the Delaunay triangulation is the Voronoi diagram, and vice versa. Dual is a moderately well-defined term in computing. It's a little bit fuzzy on the edges. Other questions? All right. Let's make things a lot simpler. Let's just, I don't know, grids. Those are nice. They also can fit in any dimension. We can have a 1D grid, a 2D grid, a 3D grid, a 4D grid. Ta-da! We can make grids. Okay? And so sometimes we'll want grids instead of triangulations. Now, how do you represent things in a grid? You could go Minecraft and make everything out of cubes. And it looks weird. Right? And you could capitalize on weird and make a lot of money. But usually if you try to capitalize on weird and make a lot of money, you will fail. Right? And how do we simulate things on a grid? We want, generally if we have a grid, it's just a fixed grid, it's always the same. Okay? And so we don't have vertices. We don't have that concept at all. We don't have faces. We instead have how much stuff is in the cell. Okay? So when we think about a grid, we talk about these as being cells. Okay? Is the generic term for a square or a cube or whatever it is, a cell. And we typically think about how full is the cell. So if I want to represent this shape, I don't store points, I don't store edges, I just store numbers in each cell. Right? And so these ones are completely full. Right? I have some points that are just completely inside. I don't have a whole lot of them, but I have some. I'll put a 1 in each of those. They're completely full. And in each of the other cells, I just store a number that is how full are they? Okay? We have done this before. This is the basic idea of rasterization, right? How full is each cell of the object, okay? And so we can come along and say, oh, this one looks like it's about, I don't know, 4.5, and this is about 9.2, and so on. We'll just put some numbers in each of these cells based on how much of that cell has information. Okay? And we can do this for the whole grid. Of course, what this cell has is 0, right? So we can do the whole grid, we just store a number in every cell. And in this space, so when we're dealing, let me back up, when we're dealing with simplices and vertices, we're going to simulate the motion of the vertices. Here, we're going to simulate the flux, the transition of material across boundaries, okay? And so we can simulate the transition of material against fixed boundaries. We can simulate the motion of points. These are two fundamentally different ways of simulating physics. They both work. We can derive physics for both of them. There are a whole set of names for these. Okay? So if this were a mechanical engineering class, we would call this the finite difference method. And then over here, we would call this the finite element method. Okay? And then we would say, what's there? Why is this an element and this a difference? It is. Okay, and there's a reason for those terms. In the space that is most influenced graphics uses different words for this. Okay, and they don't make any sense. It's not like I can explain difference in element. We're going to call this, make sure I get this light, this is going to be Lagrangian. And this is going to be Eulerian. Okay, and why is it Lagrange and Euler? Well, they were mathematicians. Did they do this? No. But it is the case that Lagrange dealt with integrals by imagining them being little pieces. And Euler did things, anyway, right? There's some reason we call it this, but this is the most common phrase. If we're talking about vertices that move around, it's Eulerian. If we're talking about cells that have stuff move between them, it's Lagrangian, okay? And these don't have to be squares. There's actually this whole space, confusingly, of making the cells be a Delaunay tetrahedration. Okay, and so these are called simplical Lagrangian methods. Even though usually when we say simplices, we mean Eulerian. But we don't have to make cubical cells, and there's reasons why sometimes you don't want them, right? Anyway, so this space gets complicated and messy, but the basic difference between the points are moving, the stuff is moving, is Eulerian-Lagrangian, okay? If we have Lagrangian, we're left with the problem, how do we draw it? In 2D, it's easy. Turn this into a grayscale map and put it on the screen. But in 3D, meh. Okay? Usually we want to know the surface of this thing. And there isn't a surface. There isn't one magical correct surface. Lots of surfaces could have created these numbers, right? So we want to create a reasonable surface that could have created these numbers. And for that, we have the marching cubes. Now, marching cubes is a weird phrase because A, it does not involve cubes, and B, nothing marches. Yes? Yeah, please. You could have made the grid a grid of pixels, and if it wasn't, you could do image resizing instead. Right? But we usually don't do this in 2D. Other questions about this before we talk about marching cubes? All right. Marching cubes is basically a big lookup table. So let's just go up here. Let's look for marching cubes. I think, if memory serves, the Wikipedia article, I forgot to look this up before class. Okay, so the Wikipedia, yes, it does. All right, great. Let's look at this image here. All right, merging cubes is basically this picture. If I have a cube, what are all possible combinations of some points are in and some points are out? And then where should I draw triangles for each of those cases? This is merging cubes, okay? We have this big lookup table. How many things have to be in the lookup table? Well, there are 8 vertices, and each of them could either be in or out, but there's some symmetries, and so we can create this lookup table. And so what do we do? How do we do merging cubes? Okay, the basic principle of merging cubes runs as follows. Let me give myself a grid again. Okay, so each of these cells I'm going to decide is either mostly in or mostly out. Okay, so I'm going to say that this one, maybe this is a 0.6 and this is a 0.3, and so I'm going to call that one mostly out and this one mostly in. Okay, some cutoff, 0.5 is a common cutoff, although we could adjust it. Okay, and so I'm going to know this for all of the cells around, right? Maybe this is 0.7 and this is 0.2, so this is going to be out and this is going to be in. And then I'm going to go to my lookup table. It's more complicated in 3D than it is in 2D. In 2D, we can sort of do it in our heads. And we're going to say, what are all of the ways this could be? This is actually one of the ambiguous cases. Either I'm going to say, we have some sort of connected shape like this, or we have a break like that, one of the two. And this is ambiguous. We could decide whether it's more clingy or it's more not. So I could decide this is probably representing something that goes like this, or I could decide it's probably stuck. But I would just pick one. So I would then say, okay, for this intersection, these are the planes. And then for every other intersection, I will decide what the planes are as well, right? So maybe this is 1 and that's 0. So if I have 2 outs down here, 2 in up here, this is the plane. Right? And for every intersection, I will just look up the planes. They will align. They will form an approximate boundary. If I then want to make it better, I will then, after I have done this, tweak all of these points to try to make these numbers closer to correct. Right? So I'll move things around a little bit to try to get a little closer to what I expected it to be. But this will give me, from a sort of Boolean in or out, it will give me the geometry, and then I can use the numbers to fudge the geometry to try to approximate the original shape. Yes?
So when we were looking at the lookup table that had cubes based on which vertices were in and out,
correct,
not necessarily what cells are in or out.
Right, so this is, we could just offset, right, every, if we think about all of the centers, that's another grid.
Gotcha.
Yep. Other questions? All right, this is meh. It's tedious. This is code you don't want to write because you have like a giant case statement. And then at the end, you're like, why did I do that? There was nothing interesting. It's just we figured out what it all is, and ta-da, we now have triangles. And then you fudge it around, but it makes a reasonable surface approximation of your grid, okay? And you can tweak it in various ways. There are papers that extend this and say, we have a better way than marching cubes. And there's a simpler version called marching tetrahedra, which anyway, there's various versions of it. But this basic concept is how we create the surface that we then throw at our rendering pipeline so that we can draw this cube of goo. Yes?
Couldn't you make it a better approximation by doing it one run and then shrinking the size of your grid and doing it again and shrinking the size of your grid and doing it again?
For the marching cubes? No.
Why?
Because I don't... I have all of the data to start with.
Okay.
It's just easier to just run over everything, create all the triangles I need. And they will only vary by a subset of the cells. So actually, this idea of doing a big grid, small grid, smaller grid is generally called the multi-grid approach and often makes many actual simulations faster. So if I'm trying to say, like, how much of this goo flows over there, that's going to be easier to do on a big grid than a small grid. But in the end, I'll get the data down to the small grid and then the marching cubes just run over the small grid. Marching cubes is actually quite efficient. It's not hard to run it in real time for reasonable sized grids. For every frame. It's just tedious to write. Other questions? Yes?
Once we then know like the shapes, we then use DDA to draw them.
Or ray tracer or whatever else you want to do. Yep. Okay. So, make sure I'm not forgetting any that I needed to do. Yeah. All right. So, we have these basic ideas. There is another family I wasn't sure if we'd have time to get to today, but we're going to talk about later, so we have time to talk about it today. So far what do we have? Let's just sort of summarize. We have Eulerian, okay, where we move the vertices. We have Lagrangian, okay, where we move stuff between cells. Typically fixed cells. There actually are combination Lagrangian or Eulerian where we move the cells and the stuff inside of them. We aren't going to go there. Okay. There's a third version. Okay. So, which we typically call meshless. Now, meshless is technically an Eulerian space. We're still moving vertices, but it's often treated as if it was a third thing. So it's technically related to this. But they aren't connected. They're just balls floating around in space. No connection to anything at all. It's often considered to be a combination between these because to draw this, we still need to create a mesh like we do for Lagrangian. We don't have something we can draw, but we're moving individual vertices. Meshless approaches are currently the most in vogue for gooey and bouncy stuff. Okay, and because when we don't have to worry about keeping things connected and we aren't constrained by a grid, we have the fewest constraints. And so we can do the most cool things. But then when we're done, we have to find out some way of drawing it. And often, in a meshless environment, we still use marching cubes. Okay, how do we use marching cubes? So often what we have is we just have points wherever, okay? And then we'll just sort of like create some sort of, essentially, if we were to imagine this, it might be easier to do in 1D. So if I have points on a grid, I'm going to put a little bell curve around each of them. And we're going to do blobbies, which we talked about earlier, right? So I'm going to have these bell curves, I'm going to add them together. That's going to give me some kind of joint function here that's going to, you know, come and go. And then I'm going to have some cutoff, and then I'm going to have a grid I put on top of it, and for every point in the grid, I'm in or out, and I use marching cubes, and I can create my surface. There are other approaches we can use here as well. But often we're going to use blobbies in 3D with our points that just float around, and then do some cutoff and marching cubes to create our surface. Okay. When we're doing meshless, we have a challenge we don't have in Lagrangian or Eulerian to actually do the simulation. In Eulerian, we know what things are connected to. And so we can create laws of physics about things that are connected to things. Right? Things don't tend to go away from things they're connected to or approach too close to them or so on. In Lagrangian, we can make rules like whatever goes into a cell has to come out, volume conservation, and so on. We'll see some details of those in the next couple of classes. In meshless, we don't have either of those. So we have to come up with some other way of saying, this point sort of has some influence on these. How do I know what those are? Very often, the answer is, we make a Delaunay triangulation of all of the points, find the ones that are close together, and temporarily pretend they were connected. Because Delaunay triangulations do everything. Okay? There are other approaches that can be used as well, but this is a common approach. Okay. I feel like I've just sort of been talking about math all day. That's sort of a little boring. Let's look for a little example of what we can do. I will just assume, oh yeah, this is a fine one. Ooh, this one's good too. Let's do this one. All right, so this is a demo video that accompanied a paper published in SIGGRAPH 13 years ago. Okay? Meshless. So we're going to have points that are attached to each other. Lots of people. Huzzah. Here's an instructive example. Okay, so what demo videos always have this characteristic. This is about how to break things. We'll come back and talk more about this. We want to break things apart. How do we do it? There's usually not a voiceover. I don't think there is in this one. Sometimes there is. So I'll provide one. We make a bunch of points. And we break them. How did we create these surfaces? Potential function blobbies marching cubes. That's where they create that line, okay? And so they have this idea of how we can propagate through things. The color here is supposed to represent some kind of stress that's being applied, so they don't want to come together, okay? And so they have this idea of how you can sort of retract things and decide how they're working, talking about sort of boundaries at different points. And then they just have lots of pictures of things you can do with it. So we can say, what happens if you have a bar and you twist it? Well, clearly, it turns into rope until it doesn't, okay? They didn't have to sit down and say there should be little hairline side fractures. They just had to model the behavior between individual points, right? So simply by saying there's a bunch of balls and they have some rules about how they work together, we get these side fractures. So a lot of what we see in these physics simulations are we don't think about the end result. We try to understand the physics behind it and create a reasonable simulation. And what do we mean by reasonable? We mean we can run it without hurting ourselves, and it looks cool. This is not what they'll be talking about for the same simulation over in aerospace engineering. Okay? They'll want to know, does it work well? We all don't care if it works well, we just care, does that look cool? And if we say it does, then we haven't lost the essence, right? And so it really is truly some amount of physics simulation, some amount of really careful thought about how we optimize, and then we try to throw things away until it doesn't look good anymore, and then bring that back, okay? And so this is one area of how we might work with things, right? And we'll get to talk about all the laws of physics and so on that go into this. Well, some of them. We won't talk about all of the ones for that one. Anyway, we'll talk about many of these, okay? And so then they have all these things, and they're always going to say, how long did it take, right? You know, it's 2.4 seconds per frame, okay? So they'll try to give you some idea about the efficiency of these things, because that's always what matters most. Efficiency always matters in simulations, because the artist will always want more detail. And so if you make it faster, they have time to run more detail before they have to deliver the film. So we always care about efficiency in these. Kaboom! Oh, isn't that nice? Yeah. You can almost always tell that demo reels are not created by artists. They're created instead by people who want to try to point out what they're doing in some way. So these are the sorts of things we can do. We could keep going here, but let's just briefly jump ahead here. So this is what we call, we'll talk some more about this. What does this look like? Why does it look like toothpaste? Right? This is this weird thing, like toothpaste wobbles. Why does it do that? And then the other thing is, how do you know? Have you ever squeezed an entire tube of toothpaste out? Right? Yeah. Right? And so we will talk about, I think we have this on schedule for a week from today, this concept here. But these are the sorts of things, and all of these examples are done in this meshless environment. We have points moving around, we then do blobbies, a surface on top of them to make it work. Right? And then they'll say, what if we make them stiffer? Oh, look. Right? And there's all kinds of things we can do here. This is actually somewhat of a surprising graphics. These algorithms were all originally created for water. And then they realized, wait a minute, real stuff is made out of the same stuff as water. Right? And so we can have this, right? Because it's all one set of rules. They can use the same set of rules for water and clay and rigid objects. Yeah. So these are the sorts of things we can do. Any questions in our last minute? Yeah. Osculating. All right. Well, that's the time I have. I'll keep running this until time technically ends. And I realize most of we've maxed out my recording, so likely the people watching the video haven't seen most of this.